Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. In this issue, New World Notes continues its reading of Jeffrey St. Clair's excellent history on the attack by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, on an unarmed, non-combatant U.S. Navy electronics surveillance ship, the USS Liberty, as it floated in international waters in the Mediterranean Sea, 13 miles off the coast of Egypt. The year is 1967, and the Vietnam War is raging elsewhere. Officers of the Liberty are sunbathing on deck in this early afternoon. Can't you hear what they're saying? Gee, this is the life. Hey, Larry, this sure beats steaming around the Gulf of Tonkin, eh? Larry puts down the Coppertone bottle. The dog tags around his neck jingle. Attention momentarily diverted, he says, "What the hell?" At the very beginning of the process, in which he is burnt alive, does he think, "Those look like new Western planes. Maybe Mirage 3s. What the hell are they doing over here? Can't see any markings." Shall I skip the sound effects as Larry is turned into a crispy critter? Yes, this is Israel Attacks America. Part 2, The Yanks Strike Back. Oops, wrong subtitle. How about Israel Attacks America, Part 2, The Yanks Bend Over, Assume the Position, and Say, "Thank you, sir. May I have another, sir?" But am I criticizing our spunky little buddy, the only democracy in the Middle East? There used to be three, by the way, but years before, your government had overthrown the democratically elected governments of Iraq and Iran. Let me repeat that. Overthrew the democratically elected governments of Iraq and Iran, and permitted or installed vicious, bloodthirsty tyrants in their place. In Iraq, strongman Saddam Hussein shot the prime minister on orders from his employer, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. The shot was not fatal, but the PM got the message and resigned. Then Saddam clawed his way into power and promptly began exterminating every pro-democracy and liberal force in the country, including the left wing of his own Ba'ath Party. Iran makes you want to cry or vomit. I believe that Mohammad Mossadegh was Iran's first ever democratically elected prime minister. Mossadegh worshipped the United States, as he imagined it from reading too many American high school history books. He was Time magazine's Man of the Year. In the fall of 1951, he visited the East Coast of the United States, New York, Philadelphia, Washington. I have a news photo of him in front of me. Google will find it if I didn't already send you a copy and you want to see it. There he is in Philadelphia, in Independence Hall, a well-dressed old man, standing, hat in his right hand, his left hand touching the crack in the Liberty Bell. He's touching and gazing at the Liberty Bell, with a look on his face that, to me, is a look of awe and reverence, close to worship, as though a burning bush had appeared to him, or the Red Sea had parted, or King Darius himself had appeared on a white charger and handed him a long-lost holy book in Persian. I probably had the same look on my face when I first saw the Liberty Bell, maybe 7 years later, when I was 8. As I recall, we weren't allowed to touch it. Mossadegh had probably begged Secretary of State Acheson for special permission to touch it, the great symbol of freedom and democracy and liberty, such as he was doing his best, in his own small way, to install in Iran. Let's make a long story short. At the time, the United Kingdom owned outright every drop of oil in or beneath Iran. Mossadegh had suggested to the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company that he'd like to renegotiate the contract. Maybe have the company pay a few modest royalties that could be used to benefit the people of Iran? The company knew blasphemy when they heard it. England tried, but for some reason failed to get Mossadegh overthrown. They asked their old war buddy, the United States, to lend a hand. Well, the CIA does not do many things well, but it is good at overthrowing democracies. It did so with its patented combination of bribery, psyops, disinformation, lies, and control of the media, here and over there. Problem solved. Case closed. In 1953, Mossadegh's scrawny, democracy-loving butt was removed from Tehran. The peacock throne was dusted off, and Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi was restored to power as tyrannical dictator of Iran. The Shah, as he was affectionately known, graced the peacock throne from 1953 until ill health and a revolution prompted his retirement in 1979. A month or two ago, New World Notes played parts from a great speech by historian Howard Zinn. Zinn noted that in the run-up to the Iraq invasion, the commercial media served no one but their corporate masters and the military-industrial complex. Then Zinn said something shocking. I will paraphrase from here on. If Americans knew some real history, the treachery of the media wouldn't matter all that much. If Americans knew of Mossadegh and the coup in Iraq and the Mexican War and our long war of conquest in the Philippines, to say nothing of England's ruinous occupation of Iraq 90 years ago, to say nothing of Napoleon's failed invasion of Egypt, if Americans just knew a little history, then when some uneducated, lying, alcoholic cowboy wannabe starts gassing about introducing democracy to the Middle East, with a little help from depleted uranium, white phosphorus, and the U.S. Marine Corps, well, you'd be laughing so hard that probably the first two or three tomatoes you threw would miss entirely. But before returning to the warm waters of the Egyptian Mediterranean, circa 1967, let's take a break and hear some period music. Barry Maguire's Eve of Destruction was a huge hit from the time it was first leaked, then released, in 1965. This protest song lists about 60 ways the adults have messed up the world. The song does hint at apocalypse in the refrain, but it's at its best when it's cataloging the sorts of mindless mayhem that then, just as today, pass as foreign policy. For the most part, the 40-year-old lyrics work great, but the temptation to update gets hard to resist. Here's an update by Eastern Connecticut's own Dean Farrell.
The USA, it is imploding, government spying, election stolen, you're good enough to kill, but not for schooling. You say we don't torture, who do you think you're fooling? You see a waterboarding and your mouth starts to drooling, but you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, oh, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fear that I'm feeling today? We got into Iraq, and now we're there to stay. And it looks like Iran soon could go the same way. When the fascists are in power, we all have to pay. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, ah, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. at all the death it caused in Fallujah, then hear the right wing saying glory hallelujah. You may leave here for 2 weeks vacation, but when you get back, it's the same divided nation. The bigotry and hatred disguised as debating, as habeas corpus is disintegrating. But if you're a fetus, then protection you're rating. This globalized world is sick and frustrating, but you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, oh, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
But to return to madness, here I am with Jeffrey St. Clair's excellent article in hand titled Israel's Attack on the USS Liberty Revisited from the June 8, 2007 edition of Counterpunch magazine online. Last week we read St. Clair's concise narrative of the events of the attack. This week we'll read the next two sections of the article. I call these The Pentagon Covers Up and The Israel Lobby Makes the Next Strike. Let me give you a quick refresher if you've just tuned in. The USS Liberty was a clearly marked U.S. Navy ship, easily identifiable as a surveillance ship and as a U.S. Navy vessel. It had been ordered to monitor communications just outside the international limit, 13 miles from the coast of Egypt in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. This was during the so-called Six-Day War, which Israel suddenly sprang on four of its Arab neighbors, and Israel won handily, acquiring thereby the Gaza Strip and the West Bank and the Golan Heights, as well as perhaps other territory. In 1967, even though it was easily identifiable as a non-combatant ship and flying a huge new U.S. flag that simply could not be missed, the Liberty was attacked, damaged beyond repair, and nearly sunk by the IDF, that is Israeli Defense Forces. Attacked with air-to-ground missiles, with napalm bomblets, with machine gun fire, and with torpedoes, one of which ripped a 40-foot hole in the hull, killing many sailors. For dessert, the Israelis jammed the Liberty's radios and destroyed its lifeboats with machine gun fire. After either 90 minutes or 2 hours, depending on which account you're reading, the Israelis tendered their apologies, explaining that they had mistaken the ship for a certain Egyptian ship. This Egyptian ship, named El Khuzair, was half as long as the Liberty, half as broad across, outfitted to transport horses for the cavalry, and in dry dock in Alexandria at the time. The scent of horse manure was indeed in the air, but it wasn't coming from a ship. The casualty count, as tabulated at the time, came to 34 sailors killed, 134 injured. This amounted to 2/3 of the crew of Liberty. Okay, let's have a go at St. Clair. When he refers to Ennis, that is James Ennis, Jr. He was then a minor officer on the Liberty. He is now a highly regarded researcher and writer on the incident, with at least one influential book on the subject. I have edited and condensed this text for the sake of radio. By all means, compare my version with the original and see if you think I've done any damage. I call this section The Pentagon Covers Up. The Pentagon lied to the public about the attack on the Liberty from the very beginning. To start with, the Pentagon denied that the Liberty was an intelligence ship. The military press corps on the USS America, where most of the wounded sailors had been taken, were placed under extreme restrictions. All stories filed from the carrier were first routed through the Pentagon, for security clearance. Objectionable material was removed, with barely a bleat of protest from the reporters or their publications. Predictably, Israel's first response was to blame the victim, a tactic that has served them so well in the Palestinian situation. First, the IDF alleged that the Pentagon had told them there were no U.S. ships in the area. Then the Israeli government charged that the Liberty failed to fly its flag and didn't respond to calls for it to identify itself. The Israelis contended that they assumed the Liberty was an Egyptian supply ship called El Khizr. This was a rusting transport ship that was docked in Alexandria at the time. The Israelis said that they halted their attack almost immediately when they realized their mistake. The Liberty contributed decisively towards its identification as an enemy ship, the IDF report concluded. This was entirely false, since the Israelis had identified the Liberty at least 6 hours prior to the attack on the ship. Even though the Pentagon knew better, it gave credence to the Israeli account by saying that the attack might have lasted less than 20 minutes. After the initial battery of misinformation, the Pentagon imposed a news blackout on the Liberty disaster until the completion of a court of inquiry investigation. The inquiry was headed by Rear Admiral Isaac C. Kidd. Kidd didn't have a free hand. He'd been instructed by Vice Admiral McCain to limit the damage to the Pentagon and to protect the reputation of Israel. Kidd obeyed the orders. Sidebar comment here. Yes, that Admiral McCain, father of honest Jack McCain, who is now running for president. At the naval inquiry, the Navy classified much of the crew's testimony as top secret, including testimony about the jamming of the ship's radios. The reason? It proved that Israel knew it was attacking an American ship. James Ennis writes, quote, "Here was strong evidence that the attack was planned in advance and that our ship's identity was known to the attackers, for it is practically impossible to jam the radio of a stranger. But this information was hushed up and no conclusions were drawn from it," unquote. Navy investigators buried intercepts of conversations between IDF pilots, which identified the ship as flying an American flag. The Court of Inquiry refused to accept evidence about the IDF's use of napalm. It refused to hear testimony regarding the duration of the attacks and the fact that the U.S. Navy failed to send planes to defend the ship. Within a couple of weeks, the court made a 700-page report and sent it to Admiral McCain for review. McCain approved the report over the objections of Captain Marlon Staring, the Navy legal officer assigned to the inquiry. Staring sent a letter to the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, the JAG, a letter disavowing the report. The JAG prepared a summary for the Chief of Naval Operations that almost completely ignored the Kidd-McCain report. Instead, it concluded, quote, that the Liberty was easily recognizable as an American naval vessel, that its flag was fully deployed and flying in a moderate breeze, that the Israeli planes made at least 8 reconnaissance flights at close range. The ship came under a prolonged attack from Israel fighter jets and torpedo boats, unquote. Note that the 8 reconnaissance flights were made in the morning prior to the attack. This largely accurate report was stamped top secret by the Navy brass and stayed locked up for many years. The 700-page report sent to Admiral McCain was prepared by the inquiry's Admiral Kidd and Captain Ward Boston, the two investigating officers. Years later, it was revealed that both men knew the report was a sham. Both believed the IDF knew that they were striking an American spy ship, and they wanted to sink it and kill as many sailors as possible. In 2002, 35 years later, Captain Boston revealed that he and Kidd had been ordered to write a cover-up. It gets worse. There's plenty of evidence that U.S. intelligence agencies had learned on June 7 that Israel intended to attack the Liberty on the following day, and that the strike had been personally ordered by Israel's defense minister, Moshe Dayan. The evidence includes radio intercepts made by a U.S. spy plane flying overhead. The Israeli jets spotted the spy plane and were given orders to shoot it down. The American plane narrowly avoided the IDF missiles. Initial reports on the incident by three top U.S. spy agencies, the CIA, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and the National Security Agency, all reached similar conclusions. A particularly damning report compiled by a CIA informant suggests that Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Dayan personally ordered the attack and wanted it to proceed until the Liberty was sunk and all on board killed. A heavily redacted version of this report was released in 1977. This amazing document generated little attention from the press, and Dayan was never publicly questioned about his role in the attack. More proof has recently come to light, proof that Israel deliberately attacked what it knew to be a U.S. spy ship. An Israeli pilot named Evan Tonai said that he had flown the first Israeli Mirage fighter to reach the Liberty. He immediately recognized the ship to be a U.S. Navy vessel. He radioed Israeli Air Command with this information and asked for instructions. Tonai said he was ordered to attack. He refused and flew back to the airbase at Ashdod. When he arrived, he was summarily arrested for disobeying orders. Well, as Baldrick was always saying to Blackadder, I have a cunning plan, and my plan is to postpone until next week hearing about how the Israel lobby is all caught up in this mess. The two short final sections next time, then, and that will finish up Jeffrey Sinclair's long but excellent discussion of the Liberty incident. Another thing I'd like to do is touch again, briefly, on the connections between 9/11 and what happened in 1967 with the Liberty incident. As I was rereading St. Clair's article for the umpteenth time, parallels were just popping into my head all over the place. It doesn't prove anything, doesn't prove by any means that 9/11 was a totally put-up job. On the other hand, it's suggestive. And it's suggestive especially because it gives you a sense of what some people in power are capable of. Let me just read off a short list of a few connections between the Liberty and the 9/11 incidents. And you can let me know if you think I've really gone off the deep end here. Evidence of foreknowledge. How about the cream of the American intelligence establishment telling the president one thing, the president lying through his teeth and telling the American people the opposite? Here's another similarity. How about glaring omissions in the official investigation? How about people with important, critical information to understanding what happened not being allowed to testify? Does that sound at all familiar? How about, to bring in only one more parallel, the missing fighter planes that are supposed to be protecting us? The missing fighter planes from the carrier group America. Do you mean to tell me that every single one of them is carrying nuclear weapons and hence couldn't come to the aid of the Liberty? How about the missing fighter jets that were supposed to protect the citizens of New York from passenger liners that were hijacked and turned into kamikazes? Where were they? Where are the missing fighter jets? Could this mean something, the fact that they're missing? Could this be like in Conan Doyle's very, very influential story, Silver Blaze, the dog that didn't bark? That's the key to whodunit. The dog didn't bark. And the pilots didn't scramble, and the fighter just didn't take off. And 2,700 lives in the World Trade Center and lives of the rescue workers, in addition, didn't get saved. Let's have a disclaimer and then see if we can end on a happier note. Thank you for listening. New World Notes is produced at the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the presenter, station management staff, or the licensee, and their expression is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. This weekly show is available by podcast, or by download from the internet, or by streaming internet at the proper time. If you're interested in downloading or podcasting, pay a visit to radioforall.net. Radio, numeral 4, all.net. You can do a search on Kenneth Doust or do a search on New World Notes and you shall find it. Email to kdoust, that's K-D-O-W-S-T, at hotmail.com. Until next time, here's wishing you a good week. Illegitimae non carborundum. Keep the faith. And here's the happy song I promised.
Let's roll. 1, 2, 3, 4. Imagine there's no heaven. Heaven. It's easy. If you try. No hell.
Below
us. And above us. Only
sky.
Imagine all the people, living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It is not hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion, too. It's a good idea. Imagine all the people, living side by side. Peace. You can say, I am a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join me and the world. We'll live as 1, 2, 3, 4. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. Brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing. All the world. Imagine. Thank you very much. Peace. We strive for peace. Let's come together.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Imagine. Saying is give peace a chance. Give peace a chance. Give peace a chance. Imagine.
I'm not a